Introduction continued. John 15. The third talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 8, 1998, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Okay, we're in the study of the Book of Acts, even though we have not got to the Book of Acts yet, and we won't for a few more weeks, I suppose. We're still in the Gospel of John. Let me review briefly what we've looked at so far in the Gospel of John, and then we'll start in John 16 today. Actually, I think we'll start in John 15 today, and then go hither and yon from there. So far, what I've suggested in looking at earlier chapters in John is that what Jesus teaches by calling the Spirit of God another parakletos, another advocate, another revealer, another persuader, is that the Holy Spirit is God himself coming into history, coming into time, and doing something unprecedented. Before Jesus came, let me back up for a second. When Jesus came to be the last and final prophet, in a sense, the one to finally let mankind in on what it was that God was up to, what it is that God was doing, what his purposes were, where this was all headed, where we were going. Jesus came and taught his disciples the truth about these things. The problem is that barely anybody believed Jesus' teaching, and the ones that did believe his teaching didn't really understand it. We see in the life of Jesus' own disciples that they seem to have just this vague kind of sense that this man was important, this man was sent from God, this man knew what he was talking about, whatever that was. And they knew that he had, as Peter called it, the words of eternal life. They knew he had the words of eternal life, but they were in no position themselves to turn around and explain the words of eternal life to somebody else, because they had not really grasped it in any kind of significant way that they could make it their own and they could be a spokesman for this gospel. What Jesus is preparing the apostles for in the upper room, in the upper room discourse, is he's saying, I'm going away. I'm no longer going to be here, a living, embodied prophet, speaking for God, giving people the last scoop on what it is that God is up to. I'm going away. I'm not going to be here any longer. But what's going to happen is you people are going to speak for me. You guys are going to represent my teaching to the world. But I'm not going to abandon you. I'm not going to leave you as orphans. I'm going to send another parakletos, another persuader, revealer, advocate, an advocate for God, an advocate for truth, who is going to bring to your remembrance everything that I have taught you. You're going to remember it, you're going to understand it, you're going to grasp it, you're going to make it your own, and your wisdom and your understanding is going to become adequate for you to speak for me, for you to go to the world and explain to the world what it is that I've been teaching you over the last several years. And that's pretty much where we have left it. We looked at a lot of details along the way, but that's the gist of what those passages we've looked at so far have been all about. We get to chapter 15, and forgive me if we already looked at that. I, for the life of me, I couldn't remember whether we had or not, but we'll just deal with it briefly anyway. We're in chapter 15, verses 26 and 27. We're in the context of Jesus explaining to the disciples that the world will hate them. If they hated me, you can bet they're going to hate you. Let me start reading about verse 17. This I command you, that you love one another. If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love it, would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know the one who sent me. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin. He who hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would not have sin. But now they have both seen and hated me and my Father as well. But they have done this in order that the word may be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. When the Parakletos comes, whom I will send to you from the Father, that is, the Spirit of truth, who proceeds from the Father, he will bear witness of me. And you will bear witness also, because you have been with me from the beginning. There's an ambiguity in that last statement, and that's the one that I want to look at. When the Spirit of truth comes, who proceeds from the Father, he will bear witness of me, and you will bear witness also, because you have been with me from the beginning. It's not exactly clear how we are to understand that. There seem to be two options here. It could be that the Parakletos will bear witness of me even as you are bearing witness of me. In other words, in the very act of your bearing witness of me, there is going to be a corresponding work of the Spirit of God who will at the same time bear witness in the hearts of those people who are listening to you. The Spirit too will bear witness of me, thereby giving your words power. And by power I mean thereby giving your words persuasive power, the power to persuade. Jesus taught and spoke the same words that the apostles are going to teach, and Jesus' words fell on deaf ears. Jesus' ministry had very, very little impact, really. But you're going to go out and you're going to speak, and the Spirit of truth is going to bear witness along with your proclamation to the truth of what's being stated, and their hearts will melt and they will respond tenderly with submission to the truth, recognizing the truth as truth. And why is it that you're going to be bearing witness of me? Because you've been with me from the beginning. You've sat under my teaching. You've been taught. You've been informed. You've been eyewitnesses to these things. You have a basis objectively in reality to know what you're talking about. You have credentials. The other way of taking it would be the Parakletos, will bear witness of me. Even so, you are to bear witness of me, because you have been with me from the beginning. That could be what he's saying as well. It seems to me they come to much the same thing, no matter which way you take the syntax. It comes to much the same thing. Namely, he's talking about something that we've seen before in the other passages, both the objective and the subjective dimension to the apostles' testimony. On the one hand, I could never stand up and claim to be an apostle. You could never stand up and claim to be an apostle. What credentials do you and I have? We were not taught by Jesus. We were not eyewitnesses to these things. We don't have the foggiest idea what we're talking about. The only thing that you and I know, we know because some eyewitnesses from the first century have told us and have written about it and have conveyed these truths to us. But we're utterly dependent upon their eyewitness account. The apostles, the actual apostles that he's talking to here, were dependent upon nobody else other than their own eyes and their own ears. They, as John starts his letter in 1 John, what we saw with our eyes, what we handled, what we touched with our hands, what we heard with our own ears, that's what we proclaim to you. So it's important to recognize this. Our faith is not irrational. Our faith is not a leap into the dark. Our faith is not just believing for the sake of believing, and it really doesn't matter what we believe. It's important to Jesus, it's important to the apostles, that what we believe is not only true, but it's verified as true and verifiable as true. They know what they know because they saw it, and they heard it, and they understood it. At the same time, rational persuasion is never enough. All the rational persuasion in the world is going to fall on deaf ears if the people listening don't want to believe it. It doesn't matter how sterlingly true something is. If it's offensive to me and goes against what I want and what I desire, I'm going to be resistant to it. I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to shine it on. I'm just going to deflect. I'm going to do anything but face the truth as the truth. What's required in order to take my face in the hands and make me stare straightly and directly into the truth? Some supernatural act of God. And that, I think, is what he has in mind here, as the activity of the Spirit of Truth. The Spirit of Truth takes us and forces us to acknowledge the truth as true and to not turn away from it and ignore it and neglect it. So both the objective rationality of the truth of the gospel and the subjective preparation to be willing to see it are required in order for anyone to ever come to believe and to embrace the gospel as true. And that, I think, is what Jesus is talking about here. When the Parakletos comes, he will bear testimony to the truth of these things right in and through your testifying to the truth of these things. I'm gonna just keep reading right on into chapter 16. These things I have spoken to you, that you may be kept from stumbling. They will make you outcast from the synagogue, but an hour is coming for everyone who kills you to think that he is offering service to God. And these things they will do because they have not known the Father or me. But these things I have spoken to you, that when their hour comes, you may remember that I told you of them. And these things I did not say to you at the beginning, because I was with you. But now I am going to him who sent me, and none of you asks me, where are you going? But because I have said these things to you, sorrow has filled your heart. But I tell you the truth, it is to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Parakletos shall not come to you, but if I go, I will send him to you. And he, when he comes, will convict the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. Concerning sin, because they do not believe in me. And concerning righteousness, because I go to the Father and you no longer behold me. And concerning judgment, because the ruler of this world has been judged. I have many more things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. But when he, the Spirit of Truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth, for he will not speak on his own initiative, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will disclose to you what is to come. He shall glorify me, for he shall take of mine and shall disclose it to you. All things that the Father has are mine, therefore I said that he takes of mine and will disclose it to you. A little while, and you will no longer behold me. And again a little while, and you will see me. The part I want to concentrate on starts with verse 7. But I tell you the truth, it is to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Parakletos shall not come to you. It's crucial here to recognize to whom he is speaking. He's speaking to 11 men that are to become known as his apostles. We'll say more about apostleship when we get into the book of Acts itself. But, you know, for now, these 11 men are the apostles or are among the apostles. It's to them that he's speaking. So when he says, it is to your advantage that I go away, I think we make a mistake if we think of that as speaking to me, although certainly that would be true. But when we ask ourselves what Jesus means by, why is it to your advantage that I go away, I think it makes the most sense in the context of the unique and particular role that the apostles have. The apostles' role is to be spokesmen for the gospel. Their role is to take this message and persuade the world of its truth and win people over to the truth of this gospel that they might believe and, in believing, gain eternal life. That's their role. That's their function. They are going to be severely, severely handicapped in that function if God is not going to make provision to solve the problem of the subjective dimension of our moral resistance, our spiritual resistance to the truth. If they're left alone to simply speak of what they have seen and what they have heard, their ministry is going to be powerless. It's going to have no effect. It's going to have no result in the world. They won't be heard any more clearly than Jesus was. They won't be any more persuasive than Jesus was. I think that's exactly what Jesus is saying then when he says, it's to your advantage that I go. You have to understand that you've been given an incredible task here. But if I don't go, the Spirit of Truth won't come. And if the Spirit of Truth won't come, yeah, there's no way you can fulfill your role. Not with any effect. Not with any result. So it's tremendously to your advantage that I go. Now, how we'd understand that? Couldn't God have sent the Spirit of Truth simultaneously with the Messiah in the world? Yeah, I'm sure he could have. I think we have a very strange theology indeed if God is so limited and so bounded and so finite that he can't both be incarnate in Jesus and active as the Spirit of Truth in the world. I don't think that's what Jesus has in mind in saying this. He's not saying it's metaphysically impossible for the two of us to be here at the same time. Rather, I think what he's speaking from the standpoint of God's purposes. For whatever reasons, hidden in the wisdom of God's design, he has determined that the Messiah would come into the world, would not be believed, would be crucified, and his crucifixion would serve a crucial function of being the propitiation for the sins of the world. He would be raised from the dead and would ascend into the heavens, wherever that is, would go someplace else, and would exist in that other state, in that other place, as, for all practical purposes, king. He would be enthroned as king, the rightful king over the entire world, over the entire universe, over the entire earth and heavens to come. And he would sit there enthroned as king as history plays out and tells the story that God wants to tell. The rest of history would go without the king being present, but history would proceed with Jesus in absentia. What's going to happen during that time? During that time, the Spirit of God, who is also at other times in the New Testament called the Spirit of Christ, it would be the Spirit of Christ who is at work in the world to continue the revealing, persuading, proclaiming ministry that Jesus began. And that's what Jesus is getting at. It's important that the ministry get carried on by my Spirit, not by me in person. Because if it can be carried on by my Spirit, then it's not limited to time and location. The Spirit of God can be operating all over the world simultaneously. I, as a human being, incarnate human being, am only in one place at one time. So it's very important that I leave and let God do the work that he wants to do through my Spirit or through his Spirit, whichever you prefer. So that's the sense in which he says, if I go, I will send him to you. That's also significant because I don't remember where those passages are, but there are a couple of passages that make it pretty paint a pretty clear picture that the metaphor that they use for this thing is that the Son ascends into the heavens and sits on the throne, at which point his Father gives him the gift of the Spirit to give to mankind. That is, the gift of the Spirit is the gift that the Father offers Jesus, Jesus having in a certain sense won it, having in a certain sense qualified himself to receive this gift. And then Jesus, in turn, takes this gift that's been given, the gift of his Spirit, and pours it out into the world. So, if I go, I will send him to you, he says, I, Jesus. Why Jesus? Because he's now been granted authority by his Father to do so. And he, when he comes, will convict the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. Now, this has the term convict, and I suppose that's okay if we use that in the sense that we, in Christian culture, as part of our jargon, use it. When we talk about being convicted, it is almost synonymous with becoming convinced that something is true. Unfortunately, when we talk about being convicted, we almost always have in mind being convinced of my guilt and being convinced of my sin. So it has a kind of exclusively negative connotation. It's not a fun experience to feel convicted. It seems to me that this Greek word that he's using here has a broader meaning than that and is more like what we mean by convince, that convince might be a better translation here. He, when he comes, will convince the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. What is he going to do? He's going to persuade the world that they have a problem with sin, that they have a problem with guilt. He's going to persuade the world, he's going to persuade us, that we, our lives do not measure up morally before God, before the standards of God's righteousness, and therefore, as we sit here, we are morally unworthy beings, worthy of nothing but condemnation at God's hands. That is a hard pill to swallow, and it's a hard sell, as any of you know who's ever tried it. To try to talk to people in the world and convince them, you know, the reality is you are a fundamentally evil person, unworthy of anything but damnation. It's hard for any of us to believe that. And yet, if we are not ever convinced of that, the gospel of Jesus Christ is absolute nonsense. It makes absolutely no sense at all if that is not a reality, if that is not true. So it's a fundamental foundational assumption that we have to have in place if we're ever going to understand and accept and embrace the gospel. He's going to convince the world of righteousness and judgment. Now, at this point, I'm torn. I don't know enough to know what Jesus is talking about here. There seem to be two equally good options, and I don't know any way to choose between them. On the one hand, what he could mean by righteousness is that standard of righteousness and goodness by which I would measure my life to come to the conclusion that I am a sinner and that I'm evil and I'm morally unworthy. That's a possibility, it seems to me. On the other hand, this term, dikaiosune, righteousness, is often used, is used by Paul in Romans, is especially, to be the term that describes my standing of being forgiven before God. I've coined the word justifiedness to translate it sometimes. That we stand justified before God by an act of God's grace and as a gift that he's given us. Again, that's something that we need to be persuaded of. That what this history is all about is the way in which God has prepared the way to grant us this gift of justifiedness and forgiveness, if only we want it, if only we will accept it. Both of those seem to fit in the context of this passage. Either righteousness is a standard by which we judge ourselves unworthy, or justifiedness is a gift of God's grace that comes to us in the gospel, as promised by the gospel. Both of those would seem to be things that could reasonably be said to be things the Spirit of God needs to persuade us of and convince us of. I'm not sure how to choose between them. At this point, if I were to bet, I would bet he's using it in the sense of justifiedness here. The next one is judgment. Judgment, I think, in the sense of condemnation, and that's why I prefer this interpretation. It seems like what he's saying is the Spirit will convince the world of the problem of their sin and then convince the world of the two ways in which that sin is going to resolve itself. It's either going to resolve itself in justification or it's going to resolve itself in condemnation. My sin makes me worthy of condemnation, and that's going to be my destiny. That's going to be my future, unless I accept the gift that the gospel promises of forgiveness, justification, as just this gratis gift that God gives me. I'm inclined to take it that way, but I'm not prepared to argue with anyone who wants to take righteousness as the standard of goodness, because I think you can make almost equally good sense out of that as well. Now we have a really kind of what has always struck me as a very bizarre thing that Jesus does here. He takes these three things that God is going to convince us of, sin, righteousness, and judgment, and he treats them separately. He says he's going to convince the world concerning sin because they do not believe me. He's going to convince them of righteousness because I go to the Father and you no longer behold me. And he's going to convince the world concerning judgment because the ruler of this world has been judged. I think what's always tripped me up is I have not seen the structure of what Jesus is doing here. I've always assumed that when he says he's going to convince us, the world concerning sin, because they do not believe in me, that there's some kind of connection between our not believing in him and the sin that he's going to convince me of. But there's another way of looking at this passage, and when you look at it this other way, the structure makes perfectly good sense, and it has to be what Jesus had in mind. He doesn't have in mind a logical connection between the sin and the reason, the judgment and the reason, the righteousness and the reason. Rather, all of these because clauses, because they do not believe in me, because I go to the Father, you no longer behold me, because the ruler of this world has been judged, all of them are explaining why it is that, in effect, going back to the statement, I tell you the truth, it is to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Parakletos shall not come to you, but if I go, I will send him to you. And he, when he comes, will convince the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. Why him? Why must he come and convince the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment? Well, three things could be said about that. One, because I ain't going to be here. The first one is, one, because they didn't believe me. It won't do any good for me to hang around. They're not believing me. The Spirit of Truth, who's going to function differently in the world, must come if they are ever going to believe the truth of what I'm saying. My staying here isn't helping anybody. I must go, and the Spirit of Truth must come. So that's one reason why it has to be the Parakletos who comes to convince the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment. I've been trying for 3 years, or 4 years, or however long it was. I've been trying for several years here, and it hasn't been working. It's important that I go and that he come to convince the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment. Secondly, I've got something else I've got to do. I have to go sit on a throne, and I won't be here any longer because I'm going to be elsewhere. So that's why he has to come, because I'm going to be absent. And thirdly, he is going to come and convince the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment, because I have prepared the way. I have given him opportunity to come and work. The ruler of this world has been judged. I'll explain that in a second. But do you see the structure then? It's not, we could have rearranged the order in which they come, and it wouldn't change the meaning of this section. He could have said, concerning sin, because the ruler of this world has been judged. Concerning righteousness, because they do not believe me. Concerning judgment, because I go to the Father and you no longer behold me. That wouldn't have substantially affected the meaning of the passage if they had been connected up differently. Because the because clauses are not about what it is he's going to convince them of, but the fact that he's the one who's going to have to do the convincing. He's going to have that role because Jesus can't play that role. One, he's not going to be here. Two, they don't believe him anyway. And three, Jesus has done his part by judging the ruler of the world to make it possible for the Spirit of Truth to operate. Now, let me explain that last one. I cannot believe we're running out of time. Is that clock right? Okay, I do? Oh, okay. Thanks. I want to look at a number of passages here, but let me try to just paint the picture of what all these passages, I think, paint the picture that I think all these passages paint. I've never seen this before. I mean, this is brand new. It's a whole new way of looking at this thing for me. A few offhanded comments that Jesus makes, this comment put together with some comments that Paul makes in a passage in Revelation that I will look at, seem very strongly to suggest to me that before Jesus came into the world, Satan, who was described, it was very striking to me as I was reading through these passages, the things they keep insisting about Satan is that he's the deceiver of the nations. His primary work is deception. He's the one who blinds our eyes. He's the one who keeps us from seeing. He's the one who advances and promotes error rather than truth. And as long as the power in the universe who spreads deception and lies and untruth and falsehood, as long as he is operative, then it's very, very difficult for you and I, as people in the world, to see the truth of the truth. because it's just one option among many out there that look equally attractive to us, and we're so readily deceived by them. When Jesus came into the world, something happened. Satan's power was broken. And the way it gets described in Revelation is he was thrown down from heaven to the earth. At least the way I'm interpreting Revelation. That's right. But he was thrown from the heavens down to the earth. And in being thrown... And that seems to be a picture of a dramatic and significant reduction in his power. I think arguably there's passages we could look at where it's clear that he's not completely hogtied. You know, he's not completely stripped of all of his power to deceive, but his power to deceive is greatly reduced. And what is it that has greatly reduced the power of Satan? It has everything to do with Jesus the Son coming into the world, being the light of the world, to shine the light of truth into the world, into the darkness, revealing the truth, his crucifixion, his resurrection. In other words, the work of Jesus taken in its entirety was a death blow to the power of Satan. That seems to be the picture. Well, what's the significance of the power of Satan having a death blow dealt to it? We now live in a radically different kind of environment in human history. Whereas previously in human history, there are all kinds of things that were different that led to mankind being closed to the truth. Now we live in an environment of relative openness to the truth. The truth is relatively accessible to us. I think it's important to see that, particularly when we go back to study the Old Testament or to study ancient religions or to study ancient cultures. I think it's important to not read our experience back into the experience of ancient people. Because if this is true, they lived in a radically different spiritual environment than we do, or at least than we did. One of the things I will be arguing is I think we are returning. But... they lived in different days and different times, and they did not have the same sort of access to truth that we have today. The picture continues that this relative openness to truth is going to last for a significant period of time, at which point Satan is once again going to be unleashed into the world and granted something like his original power again. When that happens, of course, deception will be much more powerful once again. And when that deception becomes more powerful once again, people will stop believing, the truth will not be accessible, there will be virtually no one, relatively few people, only a handful of people again, who will believe the gospel, and that state of affairs is going to last until the very destruction of the world itself. That's going to be the very last stage set for the world being destroyed, this heavens and this earth being destroyed, and God recreating a new heavens and a new earth. Okay. With that picture in mind then, let's look at a couple of passages here. We already looked at John 14, look at John 12, 31. This is just sort of a soliloquy of Jesus, starting with verse 27. Now my soul has become troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify thy name. There came therefore a voice out of heaven. I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. The multitude therefore who stood by and heard it were saying that it had thundered. Others were saying an angel has spoken to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice has not come for my sake, but for your sakes. Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. And so on. A phrase I'm interested in is this one. Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. It seems to me that if not the picture that I have suggested to you a moment ago, this is an incredibly curious phrase. What does he mean by that? the ruler of this world, which I take to be Satan, and there's, I think by the time we're done, we'll see there's plenty of reason for thinking that, that the rule of this world being cast out, what a curious thing to say. If he does not see some kind of dramatic alteration in the activity of Satan in the world from this time on. Look at Luke 10, 17 to 20. And the 70 returned. He sent the 70 out to heal, cast out demons, a number of different things, and to proclaim the coming of the kingdom of God. And the 70 returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And he said to them, I was watching Satan fall from heaven like lightning. Behold, I have given you authority to tread upon serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall injure you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven. Very interesting thing. He's saying there's one of the most dramatic things in history is happening. You, who have never had authority over the forces of deception, have been granted by me power and authority over the forces of deception because you come in my name, because I have the authority to subjugate them. You derivatively have the power to subjugate them as well. And this is a dramatic shift in human history, but never mind that. What's the thing to rejoice in? The thing to rejoice in is that your name is written, recorded in heaven. In other words, I think that you are qualified for eternal life, putting things in perspective. But again, look at this phrase, I was watching Satan fall from heaven like lightning. Again, I think what he's suggesting is there's this dethronement of Satan going on that's a result of Jesus having come in the world and begun his ministry. I think I mentioned Ephesians 2:2 last week. Here, of course, he starts in verse 1, and you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Here, of course, he's talking about the ongoing activity of Satan. Satan is still active as the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. To the extent that any human being is deceived, to that extent, in some sense, the power of Satan is operative, he seems to be saying. These other passages I'm talking about seem to be talking about the limiting and curtailing of that power, not the elimination of that power. Now, with that in mind, I want to do something really crazy or brave, I'm not sure which, and take you to Revelation 20. I don't know if this is the right interpretation, but it is so striking to me that at this point in time, I'd be willing to bet that it is. I mean, it just makes a lot of sense out of this passage. The things that we've been talking about make a lot of sense out of chapter 20 of Revelation. I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the abyss. The abyss. Remember that Jesus encountered the demoniac in the graveyard in... where? Yeah, in the Gadarene demoniac. And he called himself Legion because there are many of them. And the demons begged Jesus not to cast them into the abyss. Remember that? I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And threw him into the abyss, and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he should not deceive the nations any longer, until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Okay, Satan is described as the devil and Satan. He's bound for 1,000 years, thrown into the abyss. The abyss is sealed, so that, it says, he should not deceive the nations any longer. I just think that's striking. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark upon their forehead and upon their hand. And they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. Over these the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and will reign with him for 1,000 years. And when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. There are figures that show up earlier in Revelation. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. I saw a great white throne, and then you have the judgment of all of mankind being judged on the basis of their deeds. Okay. It sure sounds to me like Revelation 20 is describing exactly the picture that I described to you earlier. When is the time that the angel comes down from heaven having the key of the abyss and the great chain in his hand? That's in effect the ministry of Jesus. Jesus came, and with the coming of Jesus, and I mean from the beginning of his ministry through finally to Pentecost in the ministry of the apostles, during that short time of history was a time where Satan fell from the heavens like lightning. Or in the language of Revelation 20, he was bound and gagged and chained, thrown in the abyss sealed, so that he could not deceive the nations any longer. Now remember, these are images, these are pictures. Does it mean he's incapable of having any power in the world at all? No, Ephesians 2:2 says otherwise. But in this picture form, for all practical purposes, he's not having the same work of deception in the world that he had previous to this time, to this 1,000 years. At the end of this 1,000 years, a time is going to come where he will be released from the abyss. And what will he do? He will go about deceiving the nations again. And the event that he describes, this leading up to, is the Battle of Armageddon. The time where, whatever that great war is in the future, where the whole world is going to line up in opposition to what he calls the saints and the holy city, to destroy them. And they are going to be on the verge of destroying the people in Israel, in Jerusalem, when Jesus himself will return and will slay all the armies. And I don't know what happens then. That's close to the end, and then it's done. If all that's right, and I don't know, I'm just posing this as what strikes me as a very viable alternative for interpreting Revelation 20 at this point. But if all of that is right, then what exactly does it mean? How should we characterize the period between Pentecost and the time that Revelation 20 describes as Satan being released from the abyss again? I've already hinted at the first one. The world is relatively more open and less hostile to truth. I don't mean we're more believing. I mean, understand the distinction here. The world since the time of Jesus, it took him a couple hundred years, but since the time of Jesus, the world has really warmed up to this idea of Christianity. So much so that you have utter unbelieving, evil pagans in our society gladly calling themselves Christians. Right? Oh, well, I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian too. I mean, that's beginning to change a little bit in our society, but right up until very, very recent times, people have not been ashamed to take the name of Christianity. Why? Well, because it sounds like a really basically true and right and good and authentic story. It's the truth. I don't need to run my life by it. You know, I don't need to let it interfere with with my real choices and my behavior and so on. But I'm not going to call it false, and I'm not going to tell you can't believe it and take it seriously. That's a relative kind of openness to Christianity. Along with that, it seems to me that Christianity over this time has had a more or less civilizing effect on mankind. You have historians arguing this quite convincingly, I think, that were it not for Christianity, the world that we live in would be a very, very different world. This relative openness to the truth of Christianity has tended to make us more sensitive to moral issues, more concerned about being good and right and decent people, and therefore has had a dramatic civilizing effect on mankind. It occurs to me, I'm speculating here, understand that I'm speculating, but it occurs to me that Satan, during this time period that we're talking about, is not allowed to deceive people, at least to the same extent, and maybe not at all, is not allowed to deceive people through dramatic shows of power. And what I mean by that are miraculous things that are intended by Satan to delude people. Have you ever wondered why all those polytheists back in the old days really believed that stuff? That they would go into a temple and there'd be a stone that was carved by the hands of Fred down the street, the craftsman, and that was their god? Now, granted, it wasn't their god in the sense that that stone and only that stone was their god. I don't think that's what they ever believed. But it was the presence of that god. It was the representation of that god. It was the focal point and locus of that god and his activity in the world. How could anyone really take that seriously? I mean, if we go into Washington, D.C., into Lincoln Memorial and see Lincoln in grand sitting on his chair, we're not inclined to think, the spirit of Abraham Lincoln is right there, working wonders in the world to this very day. Same thing, though. Why were they so deceived? Could it be they had evidence? Could it be that the work of Satan in the ancient world was such that there were fundamentally or basically supernatural, or at least if not supernatural, incredible frauds that imitated the supernatural, and so convincingly that people had evidence, they thought, to believe in the truth of their polytheism? That they believed in Moloch because they had evidence that Moloch was really there and really active in the world? That seems so strange to us, so myth-like, so fairy-tale-like to us, because we don't live in that spiritual environment. But that's the comment I made earlier is important here. But maybe the spiritual ecology has changed radically, and that we don't understand that, and it seems so alien to us precisely because it is alien to us. That's not going on today. And we can't imagine it happening in human history anytime, anywhere. But maybe it did. Or maybe I just watched Stargate too many times. I'm not sure. But it seems very plausible to me. In any case, if you look at Revelation 13, notice, well, before I get to Revelation 13, remember the passage in Deuteronomy where Moses warns Israel. He says, if a prophet comes to you and performs miraculous signs, does all these wonderful, marvelous, amazing, seemingly supernatural things, or maybe even supernatural things, that I'll let the verdict be out on that one. But he does all these, works all these amazing wonders, and then he says, follow other gods, stone him. It's a very critical passage, and it's going to become very critical to us or our children or our grandchildren. We're going to have to remember that. I don't care what they do. I don't care how spectacular the miracle is. If their miracle is used to support the contention that we follow another god other than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as that God is actually revealed to us in the scriptures, then they are not a true prophet, they are a false prophet, and we ought to stone them. I don't imagine we'll have the authority to stone them, but at least not listen to them. Okay, that's crucial. Because, look at Revelation 13, and again, who knows whether I have this right or not, but let's see, 13:11, and I saw another beast coming out up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. And he isn't this weird? This is so weird. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. And the beast is basically in Revelation a representation of, they're all derived from the dragon that is Satan. They're all somehow gaining their authority from Satan the dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. Kissinger, last I heard. And he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. Okay? He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men. It's probably no accident. I think that's probably... he's imitating Elijah. You know, Elijah is the one who's known for bringing fire down of heaven. Remember in the contest with the priests of Baal on Mount Carmel, they prayed all day long and they couldn't get any fire to come down into heaven to light the offering. Then he puts his offering on and he has them douse it, drench it with water and make it just absolutely impossible for it to ignite. And then he prays a little simple prayer and the fire comes down, consumes the offering, consumes the water, consumes the altar and everything. And he won. Just in case you're in doubt, he won the contest. It seems to me that what he's talking about is whoever this false prophet is, he's going to perform great signs even to the point of being as persuasive as Elijah was at Mount Carmel. And that's pretty persuasive. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which it was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. And there was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand and or on their forehead. And he provides that no one should be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. Now, I don't know what that means, but the point that is striking to me is that whoever this false prophet is, this false prophet is going to perform miraculous or certainly seemingly miraculous things. Will he use technology rather than it being supernatural? Maybe. Maybe it won't really be a legitimate supernatural act, but you could fool us. As far as we're concerned, this is the sign of someone who has the authority that he claims to have. He has the authority to which we should be listening. Now, that's going to occur again in the future. Well, remember the story, the picture in Revelation 20. Satan was doing that. He was deceiving the nations. He was chained and thrown in the abyss for 1,000 years, at which case he could not deceive the nations any longer. But at the end of that 1,000 years, he was released from the abyss so that he might once again go about deceiving the nations and lead them to that fateful war at Armageddon. Could that be the different spiritual ecology that we're in right now? Satan not being able to deceive the nations means that his power to do supernatural or seemingly supernatural things in order to deceive us has been curtailed. It just ain't happening right now. But it will happen again. Okay, remember in Matthew 24:24, Jesus, in predicting the end times, says that the times will be cut short lest even the elect should be deceived. Remember that? This is going to be incredibly convincing. Whatever this thing is and however it goes down, it's going to be incredibly convincing. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to leave with this little exhortation then. It just seems to me, therefore, the biblical illiteracy of our time is going to be deadly one day. It's going to be absolutely deadly. Because the only thing that's going to keep the elect from following the false prophet in the end of time is going to be our understanding that what that false prophet is saying is true and what the Bible is saying is true are not the same thing. I don't care how much fire he's bringing down out of heaven. I don't care how dazzling the signs that he's performing are. What he's telling me is true is something that I know is not true because I already know it's true, and that ain't it. And that alone is going to keep us who are the elect from following the false prophet and worshiping the false prophet. Because otherwise, he's going to be convincing. He's going to probably claim to be from God, or at least the real God, the true God, not that false and phony God that's the invention of the Christians or whatever. He's going to somehow make the case that he represents the true supreme being and has his authority from the true supreme being. And who are you and I to argue with him? I mean, he's doing the miracles. I can't do the miracles. He's doing exactly those same things that authenticated Jesus' claims. So it must be right. He'll undoubtedly reinterpret Jesus' teaching to us, tell us here's what Jesus really meant, here's what Jesus really said, here's the truth about what Jesus was trying to point to. Christians have distorted it down through the centuries. They don't know what they're talking about. And if you and I are not in a position to know what is true and why we believe it's true, we're going to be absolute suckers for that message. No way in the world will we be able to resist. What's the moral of that story? We've got to study and understand this thing. We have to get to know the true living God, the one who really is, the one who really is there. We have to stop being impressed by every little superficial claim to credentials that comes down the pike. I mean, we live in a culture where Christianity Today ran an article where Philip Yancey and Tony Campola basically said, look, I talked to Clinton. He's a deeply spiritual man. Excuse me, but bullshit. I mean, what kind of craziness is this? What kind of world do we live in that our discernment is so dulled and we are so stupid and so biblically illiterate that we don't know the real from the false, that we can't tell the authentic from the inauthentic? And the only way we're going to get there is if we get to know God. Get to know the God who really is there. Know what his values are. Know what his agenda is. Know what his purpose is. Know what his plan is. Know what he said the future is. Know that we're not going to win here on earth. On earth, we're going to be beaten. We're going to be persecuted. We're going to be squashed. We're going to be shunned. We're going to be mocked. This is not about winning. This is about persevering until the kingdom that finally comes. That's what this is about. And in the end, that false prophet may very well kill us. Because anyone who doesn't fall in line and believe is just going to be dead. But far better death, and to be among those who will reign as priests and whatever it was, with God, I mean, with Jesus, far, far better to experience the first resurrection. Because those who have experienced the first resurrection, the power of the second death has no power over them. We will have eternal life. So far better to die in this world and live eternally than to live in this world and die eternally? I mean, is that a choice? So we have to take that with utter seriousness. We have to be really sober about that. This is really vital. And I'm stressing this with a certain amount of energy because it seems to me, well, isn't that the energy? Because I think this time is not far off. When I look at the world around me, it looks like it's beginning to get deceived. The collapse of Satan did not happen overnight. It happened over the course of a number of years. I would imagine that the arising of Satan will happen not overnight, but over the course of a number of years. And it strikes me as entirely plausible that we're in the early stages of the release of Satan from the abyss to go out and deceive the nations again. That strikes me as utterly plausible. I have never, in the history of mankind, never have we seen a time like this spiritually. We've seen unbelief before. We've seen paganism before. We've seen heathenism. We've seen cruelty. But never have we seen a time when people don't even have the concept of truth any longer. Truth itself is lost to them as a tool. And with that, I quit.